in Lumpur, you know, coming to the West, it seems like our tradition has the chance to sort of come into contact not only with Western culture, but also with all these other branches of Buddhist monasticism, you know, Tibetan and Zen lineages, etc. What strengths do you see in these other lineages and in Western culture that that you think maybe, you know, our tradition could benefit from kind of looking to or taking in? And number two, coming to the West, how have you decided which elements of our korwat and how we hold the form to adjust to the culture, and how have you decided which to stick to?
Well, I think the that's a big question.
It's two big questions, actually.
But the you know, we had these later years haven't had much contact with other traditions very much. For early years of Abhaya Giri, we had you know, quite a lot of contact with Tibetan Zen, both in terms of Bay Area Zen and say like Shasta Abbey, which is a Zen tradition, but it's got a very strong monastic community and commitment to monastic form, whereas the most of the Zen, as it's found in the States, is they're priests, they're not monastics, and you know, later years just haven't had the same amount of contact. We used to go. There used to be a Western Buddhist monastic gathering pretty much every year, and I got kind of tired of them. I think others did too. You know, it's wonderful to connect with all these, you know, sincere people, but oftentimes there was, I think our strongest connection was really Shasta Abbey, because they had a strong commitment to monastic training and lived a really exemplary community life. So and I haven't been these last years since my hip and pelvis has been sort of precluded long road trips. But and I've definitely tried to be supportive of the monastic communities that are being formed by the bhikkhunis, Aloka Vihara, Dhammadharini, and be supportive, because they're focused on monastic training, so that you know, kind of, because there's so many good things to do that. You know, it could be, you know, running around the country doing good things, and I'd rather focus my attention here, of course, you know, one of you know, there are. You know, certainly the you know, some of the aspects of you know, I think one of the things that really hit me early years of that Western Buddhist monastic gathering that really struck me, and I don't know, it was at Shasta Abbey, and it was when we had the sort of the Buddhist monastic fashion show. And explaining our robes and the background of the robes and the tradition around the robes, and what was really fascinating was that as different as all these robes are, whether it's Chinese tradition or Theravada tradition or Tibetan or Zen, is the attempt, and because there's a problem of geography and history that has separated all these traditions, and because of the distances both in time as well as in physical distances, and I mean, it's only really now in this modern age that we have the ability to communicate with these other traditions, all the different lineages talking about their robes and how the attempt was always to try to go back to the texts that they had and understand what does it mean by the, you know, like the underrobe, or what does it mean by the, like for the longest time, Chinese tradition, like City of 10,000 Buddhas, they put two robes on, two of the, their robes on, their outer robes on, for the ordinations, because you know they're really trying to follow this, what's in the Vinaya text, but they didn't quite know what it was, the attempts by Dogen he was really really looking down on the way that these the upper robe and the lower robe were getting sewn in together and turning into one kind of smock type thing, and was really down on that. So that's the roots of your Soto Zen tradition, but always the attempt is trying to be as faithful as possible, and that was really quite. Quite touching and moving, and the use of or even say in the Tibetan tradition where they live in this incredibly harsh climate, we've got these. I mean, they keep a bare shoulder. You know, they've got kind of a jacket thing, but they keep a bare shoulder because that's what it is in the Vinaya, and they probably have to get covered up with all sorts of sheep sheep carcasses. wool and sheepskins to keep warm, because it is an incredibly harsh environment. But that's the vineyard. There it is in the vineyard. They want to really protect that. And so that's something that was really quite inspiring. Because oftentimes what we do is we look at the external, and those shameless sort of Mahayanists, and you realize, oh no, a lot of it is just these distances of geography and time, and that the attempt has been pretty constant. So that appreciating those qualities, and certainly in the So like in the Tibetan tradition, then there's certain aspects of, you know, the structuring of practices you have your preliminary, for us, as especially Thai tradition, and any kind of structuring and ordering is a bit anathema. And but so, like in Tibetan tradition, then you've got some, they're very prescribed practices that you lay a foundation with, and then you go on and you continue with that. So there's a structuring of within that, plus the teachings, and so there are, you know, certain practices and approaches that are worthy of taking note of and seeing their benefit. You know, in terms of say Kawatan and Vinaya coming to the West, and you know, you know, Ajahn Sumedho was the first monk to go to the West, and he went into a culture that had quite a strong foundation in Buddhist studies and knowledge of Buddhism. The Buddhist Society had been around for a long time. Polytech Society even longer. So a lot of academic and practice elements. You know, so many people you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't live like this in England. And Ajahn Sumedho was sort of, oh, I don't know, I just want to try. And try to live this and figure it out from there. And then, you know, as one picks up the training, and you realize, well, it's, you know, one, you know, the Buddha was pretty good at recognizing what is, you know, has a universal application, and sort of the commitment to a life of simplicity. And that's something as well, as when you meet, when I've met, not just monastics in the Buddhist tradition, but when you meet Christian monastics in particular, you know, we've got a lot more in common than we do with say, Buddhist, certainly Buddhist lay teachers, because those principles of simplicity and renunciation that's the foundation of the monastic vocation, and the Vinaya certainly puts it in place, and the certain elements of that are, you know, quite sacrosanct, you know, in that, yeah, life of celibacy, no money, no alcohol or drugs. Those as a fundamental foundation, you've already, you know, set yourself apart from about 99.9% of the population, you know, which is, you know, setting up a training, and then you have you know, different elements of, because you can't really take, oh, I want, there's no reason to fit into American culture. You know, I mean, you know what? Yeah, so there's certain elements of, you know, there's one of the there isn't much of a, of a precedent for I mean, this is fundamentally a Protestant culture. You know, it's within my lifetime that it was, you know, this huge thing say JFK was actually able to be elected as president of the United States, and he was a Catholic. You know, things have changed. But it's, yeah, it's just this the perception, and many of the values are, you know, and even now, for the generation now sort of looks back at that and sort of, well, that's really quaint. But it history has a way of showing itself. Over time, and I think that we have you know, we've got a training that is you know, reasonably comprehensive in giving us the foundations of mindfulness and communal living, and supportive of the monastic and spiritual religious endeavor. So it's you know, and some things you know, I really didn't want to bring to America. It's just that, you know, from day one, I didn't want to bring like a receiving cloth I just didn't see the point of it. It's just, you end up spending more time explaining it and alienating people while you're doing it. So that. But you know, there's a few things that are that have been a bit of an adaptation. But it's like, you know, a lot of it is just practice. I mean, even just our, you know, having a jacket like this. That was like, it was really great. 1 year they. You know, it's just, you live in a cold climate, and it was something that you know, I was in Chitthurst, the early years of Chitthurst, and in those days, heat in the buildings were mostly not there, and then they're scattered around in little odd places where they were just trying to, you know, like the first I can't remember how long, but pretty much all the monks had to share their rooms with people. They didn't have kutis yet. And to share, and it was a few years where they were, you know, sharing rooms. Mm-hmm. Ajahn Amaro was, there was one kuti near the house there, But him and Tanawaro shared it for a couple years, and then it was, you know, so that. But it was cold, and it's cold in England, and everybody had sweaters on, and they're all different colors. And Ajahn Sumedho was just sort of, it looks so sloppy. So he asked Ajahn Munindo to come up with some sort of a simple design that we can have a jacket that you could put whatever sweaters you need underneath it, and it looks monastic. So at that time he had a close friend of his who was a Korean monk. So he used modeled off the Korean tradition. But anyway, that was really criticized in Thailand, as not so much in Wat Bapong circles, although some to some extent, but certainly in the especially like administrative circles and the hierarchy. And then one year, a very senior monk from Wat Bawan, and he was the secretary to the Mahathera Samakho, is a spacing on his name right now. I traveled with him and was his attendant and translator when he went. No, different monk. I'll think about it. But anyway, he was very, very influential in the world of Sangha politics, and being at Wat Bawan, which is the heart of Damyut, that's the head of the Damyut, very influential. And when he went to England, and we were there for a month and traveled around, and we put out sweaters and jacket for him, and he, no. And we said, okay, maybe he's really down on us, and thinks we're really, and this is in the summertime, and it's cold, even in the summer. And then the night before he left, he went around to all the different monasteries. The night before he left, as we were taking leave and asking for forgiveness, he praised the practice. He praised the standards of Vinaya, and then he said, you know, when I was in Thailand, you know, I would hear criticisms of say Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Chah's tradition, going to England and adapting, not doing it like Thailand. And he said, so I made a determination to try it out, and I did. And then he said, and now you can see my arm here. It's all cracked and bleeding. And it's really, it was, he said, this is really not, what you've done is really appropriate for the environment, and how you've done it is appropriate. I'm going to take this back and show people that you can't be done. You know? So that it was really quite touching. Those are ways. There's, you know, you just have to sort of, some things are are different from the way is a part of American culture, but I think it's something that is. There are many beautiful things that we can learn, because I mean we have our culture, but it doesn't mean it, because culture is a conditioned thing, it's a conventional thing, but there we'll say that for us as Buddhist monastics and Buddhist practitioners, what we're trying to do is set conditions that give us the opportunity for learning. And so that the opportunity to learn how to look after each other, and because there's a very strong cultural value of independence, and everybody really take care of themselves, which is has a strength. But then also to be able to learn how to adapt and how do we look after others? How do we care for others? How can we manifest qualities of, say, respect or deference? Despite a very strong ethos of equality, I mean, say America right now is one of the more unequal cultures and countries on the planet. So that's a great ethos, but it's not really lived, and in, as a human culture, what are human qualities that we can be cultivating that allows us to live together in a way that we're not making more suffering than we started with?